This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, Guy.
Hello, Gary. I say it seems weird having not seen you for over a week.
I miss you.
I know you do. I don't miss you at all.
I know. You know what? It's so nice to be back with my family, I have to say. And it's nice to be back to the real world and London and all the things that I like to do. And my kids, of course. What I miss is the bus. I missed getting on that bus and my life is on hold.
And it's, your life is so few things they're all there.
There's no chaos on the bus. There's people to protect you. But also miss your sense of humour. I miss having the laugh that we had over the last couple of
years. I miss the laugh because I'm not having much of it. I've moved into a new house, which is fantastic. And I'm incredibly grateful for it. But, you know, little things like a kitchen would be nice. So
in the old days, you would have said a studio would have come before a kitchen. You would have just got takeaways and be done with it.
Do you know what the irony is? I've got a studio. I'm sitting in my studio. That went up. It's like, never mind the kitchen, as long as I've got my studio.
I'm glad to hear it.
Dave Davis.
Where to begin? He created the most inspirational rock and roll guitar sound.
Yeah. But it's also, when you actually stop and look at it, it's just too enormous to comprehend, you know, just how much.
Right. I think, you know, their inspiration, their influence was so great. You and I wouldn't be sitting here right now.
I wouldn't
live in this house. You know, the baton that got passed from the Kinks to the Who and beyond in rock and roll is so incredible. Their place in the history of things is huge.
Absolutely huge. And it's a real, real honor to have this guy on.
And he's got a new book out, his latest biography, because I think he had one a few years ago. This one's called Living on the Thin Line. And Guy and I have both read it, and it's
brilliant. It's amazing.
It's amazing. So let's get him on and find out what stories he has to tell.
Welcome to the Rock On Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
Well, it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
So great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock On Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Yay! Can you see us?
Yeah, you look great.
Fantastic.
A fantastic honour to have you here to get to speak to you. You're an absolute legend to us.
You're, you know, up there with one of the greatest influences on all of us, what you've done and what you've given this world of rock music. Is that one of your paintings in the background?
Yeah, I've got them all over the place. I'll finish them one day.
Is that a spaceship or something? What is it?
To be honest, I don't quite know yet. I'll let you know when I find out.
That's interesting. So are you better at finishing songs than finishing paintings then?
No always.
Well, you've certainly finished plenty of songs.
Yeah, that's nice of you. Thank you. I feel a bit humbled and freezing.
Well, you look very well. Are you buzzed on this, on the reaction the book's had?
Well, yeah, really. I just, you know, it's hard. You know, it's hard doing stuff. And people think, oh, you know everything. But no, bug all, really. You just make it up as you go along. But obviously, not the book. I mean, make up.
I was going to say, wait, I've just read it. What?
Art. You mean art.
And the way you do things, you make it up.
But do you find, Dave, I found because we've all written books here, When I wrote mine, and you're amazed at the stuff you remember, but if I pick up a copy of it now and look at it,
it's
all gone. But all the stuff, it's like I was storing it on the drive until I could get it down. Then your brain goes, I don't need this anymore.
The music will restart memory.
The music. So listening to... So did you do that? Did you go back and listen to the tracks?
Yeah, because I was in that same place thinking, oh, great, now push comes to shove and I can't remember anything. So I started from the music. And the music takes you back to places and people and where you went and what you did.
What a lovely affirmation for music, that is.
Well, to me, that's all there is.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about it, the memory in your life and your nervous system, everything.
Dave, if you think back to your earliest time then, back in your family house in Muswell Hill, what is that song? What is that music that makes you think, that's me as a kid and some of the earliest stuff I remember?
I think it's weird. It's different for everybody, isn't it?
But I've got to get to the root of this question. Was there a sort of style of music that was in your house that your mum and dad liked? Was it because I grew up next door to a pub in Islington. And in this early 60s, that pub, rock and roll hadn't happened to them. The older generation that lived and frequented in that pub were all singing, you know, old musical songs,
Mrs.
around
Mills.
The piano. And that's what I grew up.
Yeah, I bet it was a lot more honest as well. The generation before mine were a lot more honest and get up and do stuff and stop moaning and just doing stuff. And I think they learnt that from, you know, suffering through two wars. And they had to infuse themselves with optimism, even if it wasn't there. Islington's a great place.
But yeah, that's why I'm an Arsenal fan.
Oh God!
But actually, there was a bit in your book there were two bits in your book at the beginning that I really connected with. One, I worked in a greengrocer's as a school kid, which I know you did, right?
Yeah.
And putting up the show, and I worked with my brother, and putting up the show and talking to...
Nightmare, right?
So you know, I'd sell spuds to the local people in their council houses and flats, and I'd sell avocados, which I thought was a dessert, to people who lived in Canonbury. but also the other thing was my band originally rehearsed in the Camden Head in Camden Passage.
Really?
And that's where the Kinks rehearsed.
Yeah, absolutely. I loved it there, but you know.
Did you know that at the time, Gary?
Hey, do you know what? When I read the book, I had a vague memory of people saying the Kinks used to rehearse here. Yeah, we did.
I remember that Brian Epstein came to audition the Kinks.
Hello.
At Camden Head.
He said no, right?
No. No, not for me, mate.
So hang on. Just string this image out. Brian Epstein, wearing a rather posh suit, I would have thought, walked into the Camden Head.
He did look cool. I mean, I always thought, you know, he looked very cool. Good dresser.
And what songs did you play him?
I can't remember. It probably would have been "I'm Hog for You, Baby." I can't get enough of your love, or something like that, or not Beatles.
I think
he liked us.
How did he get to hear of you in the first place?
It was our upper class management.
Oh, of course,
and they knew everybody. I said they did.
Grenville Collins.
Grenville's great. Oh, my great guy. Great. Yeah. And he was so, he used to take the mickey out of each other, really. Silly little working class kids and a silly posh toff.
But it was
good camaraderie. It's good. The mix of the vibe was great.
Well, especially it must have been fun because he put you on that society circuit, didn't he? All those sort of posh parties.
Well, he did, yeah. We wouldn't know what they were, you know, gruffy little kids trying to make a blob, yeah? Few blobs.
But did you get to support the Beatles because of Brian's interest?
Probably, yeah. And I remember that gig at the Beatles, and I watched them and I thought, we're better than that, we're good. I was so vain and young and I thought we were better than everybody, but sometimes you have to be like that to get through.
You had a bit of a vibe with Lennon, didn't you, for a bit? A bit of a kind of
friendship.
Yeah,
which sounds yeah, amazing. Someone who's a bit like, whoa, about John Lennon. It's incredibly cool for back then.
But I didn't know the business.
Yeah.
How are you supposed to act? Are you acting on how are you supposed to act now?
Yeah.
There was no template or
yeah,
way of acting. You just said, oh, Eddie Cochran can do it. Why can't I?
Lennon was quite jealous, wasn't he, you said in your book?
Well, I think he was wary. He was very wary of everybody, I think. Which, when you come into this business, especially at that time, you didn't know if you were going to be beaten up or it was tricky. I don't recommend going into the show business.
Yeah, it's a bit late for us, I'm afraid, but thanks for the advice, Dave. But but what's it, because that time is such a size, especially even the thing of having the posh manager and the society board, because it was the one time of, I would say, the truest meritocracy time when a lot of those barriers were broken down. But also, you're in a world, you're talking about don't go into show business. This is when show business is becoming the music business that we know, isn't it?
There wasn't really a music business. Yeah. It was kind of like...
It was packaged tours. It was, you know... It was kind of replacing the old music hall variety packages, weren't you?
Well, it's funny you should say that because I come from a pretty big family. Six sisters, one brother. And...
Oh, yeah, who's that?
I can't remember his name. But a big family, a big working class family. You know. I have to be really corny and say that we were surrounded by an immense amount of love and encouragement. Mm-hmm. Like, we can do stuff, and oh, no, you can't do it. All my mates at school used to laugh at the fact that we were trying to play guitars. Well, no one's still laughing. but the fact that we were doing it, you know, and my family were very encouraging, getting stuff done, or trying that song, trying the song. Because my family grew up, my mum and dad especially, they grew up with music. My sister grew up with Oklahoma and South Pacific and... Oh, it was wonderful, wonderful, talented people. And that's all going on in the background.
You started off with that kind of blues R&B palette that everyone had. But then the breadth of the songwriting, there was clearly had been such a wider world that you've been exposed to.
Oh, yeah. But it was really quite... I think in the very beginning, it was... The guys, pioneers from like the country and western, like Hank Williams, and obviously the blues was because it was so new to us. But what was interesting, I was listening. Remember being a kid, I'm trying to pick out a few chords, and listening to Lead Belly, thing about being working on the railway. I think my ankle works on the railway in King's Cross. Yeah.
Well, that's why skiffle was fitted in so well in the UK, wasn't it?
Right, and it was easier. And I was a big fan of Lonnie Donegan.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think he kind of broke through the class thing or the type of music we were listening to. It was great.
Where were you hearing your first blues records, though? How did that... were you going to friends' houses who'd managed to find imports?
Yeah, I had a friend at school who... His name, it's not a joke. His name was Johnny Burnett.
Wow.
And always imagined it to be Johnny Burnett. And his family were American. They used to get records from the States.
Ah, wow.
And one day... He played me Sweet Little 16 by Chuck Berry. I thought I was going to go mad. What is it doing? It's amazing. But it's funny when you look back at these incredible influences, there's a lot more going on than just what they're playing. Mm. The feeling, you know, paintings falling off the wall, everything. It's like film set, you know. Listen to a movie. It's amazing. They call it nostalgia in the girls.
I love that. The fact that, in you know, now we look on YouTube and see things, you know. Now, in those days, you know, you really listened to the record and you sat there going backwards and forwards on the record until you'd found how to play it on your guitar.
Because I was hypnotised. No, I never gave up. If it couldn't work it out, you'd make it up. You know, you make something up. Make it sound similar.
The other thing we have in common, of course, Dave, and it's
oh, I'm the great admirer of your music.
Oh, thanks, mate. No. You know, but thank you. But the other thing we have in common is I've got my.
I know a bloody heart is. You know.
Cheers, mate. But is I've got. I know. I played.
Oh God, I really enjoyed. Was it Peter Medak?
Oh, the Craze.
Yeah. Because we were approached by the Craze, bless them, some years before. And because my sister, Gwen, her friends were the Craze when they were young. So I come from, not from Muswell, they came from Islington. My family were Islington, Islington people. And it was a part of our history, a backstory. And Gwen said that whenever the Craze were in the neighbourhood to get out of town. Because we didn't realise, obviously when we started and the backstory of the choir member, we didn't realise that was going on at first. We did eventually, the choir member.
But you never met the Craze? You never met the Craze?
No, but my sister knew them. And whenever they used to come around, they used to send me to my other sister's house and just say, Dave's not in. Me being the young, cute little boy and all that.
Right.
Get Dave out of there.
Oh, right. You weren't allowed to see.
I said, what are you talking about?
Dave, my thing that what I was talking about having in common with you is obviously being in a band with my brother for many years. And I know
was
how
it
pleased.
Good?
Well,
was it, good?
It was good, actually. And I got on well. But it pleased my parents because both of us were doing well in this group. And I guess your parents must have had been really pleased to see that Ray
because
you were his little brother, weren't you, you know?
Oh, yeah. And in those days, nobody had any money, right? It was a big wad of steel. And everybody was saying, you can't take up music, you know, nobody gets any decent money. My mum was happy. For starters, she could get rid of us. And it's a job.
Yeah.
Make your own bleeding money. That sort of attitude, you know. You know, I have very fond memories of growing up in Muswell Hill, North London. And it was a very exciting time. That time was very exciting. Because it seemed like you could do anything.
Because you stayed there for a long time, didn't you, Dave? After that, this is what I find interesting, is after your success, rather than moving straight into the groovy Chelsea pad, you stayed in Muswell Hill.
I remember thinking that when I was going to buy a house, I thought, I got mate who lives off Kings Road. I'm going to have a look at places, see what I like, yeah. And I felt homesick. All of a sudden you find yourself in New York or LA and think, wow, we didn't know what we were doing.
Part of it must have been because you were very young. You were 17, weren't you, when you had your first
hit? You were incredibly young.
It's scary to think back now.
Yeah, that age difference between you and Ray, which is only 3
years.
Yeah,
but in those days,
at that age, that's a lot. That's a lot. That's what I mean. Exactly. That was a gulf. Yeah.
And was there ever that feeling from Ray, oh, I've got to take my little brother around with me? Or was he, were you absolutely bonded?
It was like Ray was a funny guy. When we got on the football field, we were really together and protective of each other. But after that, you were on your own, kid.
Yeah.
We were always close. I mean, impossible to have spent that amount of time and years working together without being close. But there's different types of being close.
From reading your book, a lot of your more overt kind of disagreements were with other people in the band.
Well, I think right now we're weird to each other, but we're very protective of each other because of the family connection. You know, it's all right for me to call them back or whatever. But if anyone else does,
I
can see what you're saying, Dave, about, you know, you feeling homesick just going to view a property in Chelsea. And that Ray's obsession with home has always been there. I mean, you know, 10 years later, he writes Muswell Hillbillies album. You release that album. You know, it's so much part of your DNA that you're trying, you know, both of you trying to tell the rest of the world about the characters that you've grown up with, that the characters that are in your family, the interesting parts of old London that seem to be dying out. It's a really interesting time because you've got Harold Wilson talking about the white heat of technology. You've got tower blocks going up. The empire had gone and everything you knew about being working class and socially and culturally could be wiped off the map. And there was a sense of preservation that you guys were trying to put around it.
Well, thank you. You're right. It's true. And I think it was a good job. I was so young because I could blame everything on Ryan because he was older. And I had a kind of an attitude of just go and do it and, you know, not worry about what political party you. I didn't know anything about that. Just living. I think a part of what we'd lost about that time is just living, like having the sense to know how to care about each other and who to look after and who to protect, that which had kind of gone though. So it's like a sort of gang warfare now, even in politics, like gang warfare.
And, it's all about everything is divide and rule. Everything is, you know, that's...
Yeah, and politics, I shouldn't say it, but politics really depressed me. I'd rather make friends with someone or try to and have a pint and say, what's going on? How do you feel? Because that's, in the end of the day, when you're left alone with the guy or people, you say, what do you talk about? It's all about how you feel. Then that's where we're losing a lot, the core connection as human beings. How do you feel, mate? Oh, a bit dodgy. You know, just real things. Not, no, do you like wearing new Savile Row suits?
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
But I mean, I think what's the epitome of the Kinks, you know, when you were in your absolute pomp, is being able to tell stories about the kind of weird characters, the old...
Which, from my mum and dad, but our extended family were very close. Ray has written about this character in many guises, in many ways, in songs and with our Uncle Frank, so classic. You couldn't make it up.
My dad was Frank.
Yeah, I probably knew him as well. He was like a cartoon character. Oh, why am I happy? All this. They were real people. They weren't comics, but they weren't. That's how people were. And that when you moved to Muswell Hill, got a little bit posher. Yeah.
There's a whole, I mean, what's brilliant is taking those characters and, I mean, something like Arthur, where that's based on your brother-in-law, isn't it, who went to Adelaide?
Yeah.
But then doing a whole treatise on empire and the fall of empire based on from that one little, you know, nugget of an idea.
Yeah, I think it's because Ray was the eldest, all right, and by 3 years. He was also a very quiet kid, and I think it helped him form his style of writing. And that was a great plus. I think because really, one of her sisters who died on Ray's birthday, she had a heart problem.
Oh, yeah, it's a tragic story. Tragic.
She was a great painter, artist, and a musician. We learned a lot from her, but I think it was almost like that analogy with the story of the secret cause. I think Ray was kind of waiting for Rini, I don't know, to impart some sort of info, code or something, she did, in a way, she did. Now, I think Ray had been searching for this lost chord all his life, maybe, before we know. That's how he honed his craft.
There were three great London bands, weren't there, all telling stories of working class people. That's obviously you, Small Faces, and The Who. Yeah, but most of all, I would have said, you know, I mean, let's look at Arthur. You know, Guy just mentioned Arthur, the concept album, which was 1968, before Tommy. I mean, it must have been one of the first concept albums. Am I right to say that? Well, you were.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think we knew what The Who were doing, and then what are they trying to copy us again? What are they doing?
There was a script and a TV idea with it,
ITV had Ray was working on a film script for TV with who was the guy, Julian Mitchell, I think the guy was his name. But that all kind of collapsed. We had all the music, so we didn't make an album. Also, Pi Records let us use the big studio. Bigger knobs and things.
You'd had all these massive hits before. You'd been a massive act, and now they let you use the big studio. What?
Yeah. Was there a sense of anger though when Tommy came out? Because I mean, I said I was talking to Guy this morning. There's a track on Arthur called Johnny Thunder.
Oh yeah,
Portsy.
Yeah. Real guy.
Is you know, something that Pete completely uses in Tommy.
Well, there's three bits of it which are kind of it's just essence of Tommy. You can say it's nothing apart from that one chord sequence. But more to the point, did Johnny Thunders get his name from that track?
Well, Johnny Thunder character is based on it's Ray's song, so I don't want to speak out of line.
Yeah, fair enough.
Why not? There was a biker in Muswell Hill. He was so out of place. He thought he was James Dean or Brando or someone. And he really dressed up for it. And he had a girlfriend who used to dote on him. And have you ever been to Muswell Hill?
I have. My stepdad's from Muswell Hill. So I used to go there a lot as a kid. I can't remember the name of the road.
The top of the hill. No, it's actually a hill. At the top, it's a great view at Hornsey. Johnny Thunder used to ride his bike roundabout, and one slope is a footrest got caught on road, and the bike went topsy turvy and wonky, and the poor guy died. But that was my view of what eventually became Johnny Thunder. Johnny Thunder lives on water. Feeds on madness. So it's partially romanticized, but as with all the great writing, Ray is a great writer and documentary of our times as well.
Yeah. Well, that's actually, Dave, I want to get on to, because you've written some fantastic songs, and it's probably quite nice, but the difference, I would say, certainly in this earlier stuff, between you and Ray, as you were saying, Ray would basically find a character or invent a character and then base it around someone someone that you knew or someone part of your extended family or some local character and tell a truth through that. Whereas you're right, Death of a Clown, Suzanne's still alive. You took much more direct experience, didn't you?
That's what I thought rock and roll was really about. People having a good time or finding out how to have a good time. And that's why I think that whenever they talk about rock and roll, well, they really, you know, that's why Chuck Berry has fulfilled a great part of that heritage or lineage or whatever you call it. Because he was singing about, I mean, who could sing about a menu? It's like, when it all rhymed and that, wow, it's kind of pretty incredible. I mean, you go home and you play Too Much Monkey Business or play it in the studio. It's amazing lyric. You know, it's about life that was going on then, but it's funny. He had the knack of knowing when to use humour.
I just want to go back to what Guy's saying, Dave, about you putting your personal stories into your songs, because Susanna's still alive. I mean, this is quite an amazing story that reveals itself within your book. She was a girl that you met at school when you were 15, was it? And
yeah,
you want to tell some of that story?
Yeah, I get quite emotional when thinking about it. It was like, yeah, it was like my first love at school, and she was older than me, and I felt her heels pursuing when it, you know, it's, oh. Those were the days when, oh, shit, where do I start? When do I end? Still going.
She got pregnant, didn't she? And mum didn't want you two to ever be together, and she was sent away.
She was worried about the boys not having jobs.
Yeah.
No, worried about me ending up being a barrel boy. It was good to be a barrel boy, but ending up working in the market. And she wanted better things for us. And she, the day I walked in with Sue on my arm and said, "Mum, we're going to get married," thinking she was going to explode in some rapturous, joyous moment, she went, "What have you done, David? Like, have you ruined your life?" I said, "Well, man, we're in love." Oh. But to her, it was like a setback. We were heading on the course in her mind of a life that was going to be more bountiful than, you know.
Mum's always know.
But she was pretty smart, my mum.
What's really moving in the story is that you didn't see your child for 30 years.
Yeah. No. And then I did. Then Tracy called me up at the office.
Oh, you don't have to go through it, Dave. Sorry. It's such a great part of the book. And the way you put your art in, you're still thinking about this when you write that song, Susanna's Still Alive, and is really moving to us as people who like to listen to music and get something from that music.
Yeah. But the fact that it's a real Romeo and Juliet story.
Yeah, I know. It still moves me today, and I think about it. But, like, you know, you move on, your life changes, and you embark back on this great adventure of playing in the rock band, hopefully to be the next Eddie Cochran.
Because I want to get onto the other one, because what's interesting, because Death of a Clown, which is a masterpiece, this is a fantastic song.
And there's
a very funny story about you doing a German TV with it in the book. But it's interesting how you're dealing with such massive elemental things, right? If you look at your titles, the Susanna's Still Alive, then Death of a Clown. Everything is like totally.
But I love that. I love the there's a YouTube video you sent me, Guy, of Dave doing it on TV somewhere.
Have you done it on TV?
At the end of it, you're sticking up two fingers to someone. I don't know who you're doing. Through that person.
Probably the cameraman, probably.
but it's a really interesting song as well, isn't it? Because you'd put it was on a Kinks album, but it also came out as a Dave Davis solo record.
That's right. Yeah. The management, Robert and Grover, at the time thought it could be a chance for me to embark on a solo career, which I kind of toyed with the idea, but I was a bit a bit of a homeboy, though, even though I don't know the girls and champagne and...
Well, you still were, but that's the funny thing for the because it sounds like when you write this song as a moment of kind of self-realization of realizing you've got to change, but then you don't really, do you, for a while or so?
Yeah, seems. Give me a pint. No, it's really funny when my whole life has been like that. It's like wanting things to change so much. And then you look around and then how has it changed? Has it changed so much? You know, people talk the longer words and they speak in like a different language in a way. It's a very different language, the English language in those days. Me and Ray communicate by telepathy, I think, because we never really had a conversation unless it was about the Arsenal or Derek Tapscott or something. Oh, yeah, and then we'd open up. How are you? Oh, yeah, not bad. Okay.
Are you talking about the sort of dishonesty of blokes that we're always talking? We talk about football or we distract. You know, we're not really ever going to be emotional with each other.
No, yeah, I think you're right. The leftovers from, I think, our parents in the war years. We can't talk about weird stuff like psychiatry. Don't talk about that. Stiff upper lip and all that. It was the leftovers from that era, really. Mm. And like, of course, when we got into show business, which was full of gay people, even before gayness or being gay was legal. In 65 and 6, I think it only became legal in 66, I think.
No, it was like 70. It was actually incredibly late or something. It was...
But in show business, when you're in business,
But also, because your attitudes on that front, I must say, were so incredibly ahead of their time, which is brilliant, which is that there was no issue, which is like kind of where we are now. Yeah.
You talk really casually in your book about your bisexuality at the time.
I think I was young enough to not be tainted by all the social hypocrisy or whatever, you know, of the time. Mm. And I had boyfriends, so I used to go clubbing with me and my mates. We would dance and I only realised how much I adored women after I had a very deep relationship with a guy.
That was the TV presenter?
Yeah, Michael. Johnny Apted. Yeah, and... I loved them in a way, but I wasn't in love with them. Like, it took me ages to work out what it was. But it was like, it's like appreciation and wanting to share things rather than get a gear off, mate. And but there was that element as well, though, of the get your gear off. But as a person, I do, you know, you've got feelings. And why should I? Like art and be a little bit effective and want to wear unusual clothes. And I loved unusual. Unusual was my main thing as a kid.
Well, this was an amazing time, though, isn't it? Of, you know, men growing their hair, wearing more feminine clothes, and working class people suddenly mixing with middle class, upper class people. I mean, this had ever happened before, it seemed to me, you know?
Yeah.
I remember I was 16 or 15 and I saw a picture of Oscar Wilde. And I thought, wow, what a cool dude. I want to be like that.
That TV program of you doing Death of a Clown, you could actually be auditioning for the part of Oscar in a
Oscar.
Play.
Well, listen, what's funny, though, is that picture you're talking about was taken just as he'd arrived in New York to do the tour of America. And that was like the first rock and roll tour, really. I mean, he spent a year touring America then and becoming a superstar. Dave, what I want to get on to is you with Shell Tell Me and You Really Got
Oh,
Me.
Oh, yeah.
And the moment that you personally found a sound that was just about you. You found a sound that was going to be about every rock and roll guitarist for the next 50 years. I mean, that riff, everything about that riff, the simplicity of it, the rawness of it, but you've got to tell us about how you came to find that sound.
out of frustration. I didn't know what to do. You know, it was like, and we used to have an electric shop, a radio shop next to Denmark Terrace where we lived, two houses down. And the Ted, his name was Davis, no relation, Ted Davis. I walked in there one day and there was this little green amplifier. And I said, I bet that sounds good. Bought it for 10 quid and expecting the whole world to change overnight. I plugged in there, oh man, back to square one. And out of that frustration, I cut the Cullinan speaker up and then things started to happen. When the grit started to come out of the app, not bloody hell.
Because didn't you also, because you give this description, the book, where it sounds like you had quite a few amps, which is like, it's quite impressive, and you were like plugging amps into other amps. Like,
yeah, it's funny because...
An AC30, which is a bit posh.
That really, I mean, there might be a timeline problem there. It happened a bit later. But also you've got to remember, luckily, we had a relative, my sister's husband, Mike, worked at British Airways, could you believe? He was a musician, a guitar player. And he introduced me and Ray to Burt Wheaton.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Heard so
I love
Wheaton.
To play.
Yes, playing a day.
Playing a day, yeah.
But that was the only way to learn. You know, the first time someone gave me a chart of music, I thought, oh, fuck. Oh, sorry. And what I used to do, I used to predict the notes that were coming, thinking I was making up a scale because I thought what should come next.
I know exactly what you mean.
And that part of that's true. That's what you do in music. You learn it to make it up. I was actually very, very interested in science fiction. And music is like science fiction when you start it out. It's kind of like...
Future.
You know, it's the future. Maybe it's a waste of future. Transport ourselves. It is, really.
Guy, there was probably, if he's in the studio with Shel Talmy, there's probably a WEM sitting there, right, that belongs to the studio. So it wasn't necessarily Dave's amp, I'm thinking.
That's true, yeah. Well, no, it's only in the book you talk about in your bedroom and you had... And it sounds quite technologically sophisticated of how you're taking outputs from one amp and putting them into another one. So making that amp a preamp. I was thinking,
but nevertheless, it was a razor blade that made this first
original sound. Yeah, messing about a razor blade and a funny little amp.
And then obviously the follow up to that, all the day, all of the night, was really, pushing that even further.
Yeah, I always thought that All Day was what you really got we should have been. But actually, when you play them back to back, You Really Got Me has got a place in history.
The door certainly.
Because we didn't know what we were doing. That's a great thing about music, is like the best stuff happens when you don't know what you're doing, I think.
There's a lovely comparison you make as well, when you say that how that early stuff you did completely influenced all the bands around at the time, from The Who and everyone, we all know Can't Explain comes straight from Really Got Me, and The Doors,
which you
completely stole it. The Doors just stole it, didn't they? For Hello,
that's a blatant
steal. Yeah. What's interesting is it's your later stuff that influenced everyone who came later, to Blur and Madness
happens. Yeah, good. I'm glad.
It's a fantastic legacy.
That's a good point, though, Guy. Was there ever a feeling, Dave, in your career that you'd pushed the door open and then other people were just sort of running in over the top of you sometimes?
Yeah, I guess so. But like when you're young, you think you're kind of invincible a bit. You think, don't worry about it. No. There'll be something else. It's like my old man used to say, don't worry about it. Something else had come along.
Because that period of the mid-60s is things are moving so fast, so insanely fast, aren't they? If you think of what a record sounded like in 1964 compared to what a record sounded like in 1960, like what a guitar sounded like from year to year.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I remember that when I'm, because of my movies, there's a lot of different stuff going on. Like Saturday night and Sunday mornings, really an incredible cultural, had incredible impact on me and Roy. And when I met Albert Finney, it was like meeting a relative. There was all this stuff going on. Tom Courtney, it was like meeting a brother. And it's like, wow, it's not just music, it's everything, the fashion.
And you all used to play football together, didn't you? There was some Showbiz 11 you used to play for.
Yeah, Tom Courtney was a good footballer, probably still. But it used to be funny, it's Showbiz 11. It was serious, but it was a joke at the same time.
I think what you're talking about as well is that it was an amazing time, because suddenly working class people had an art form that wasn't just a joke like music hall. You know, this was seriously talking about.
Hey, I like musical.
I like musical, but you know what I mean. It wasn't just joking about it. It was about real gritty stuff. And was finding a place out in the in the public imagination.
Well, no, it did, and it happened in a strange way, because a lot of Ray's writing, not nurtured, but everything's nurtured by everything art. It's like events in time, meet a guy in a pub and you write a song about him. Ray is a great observer of people and what they do, why they do it, and where they're going or where they think they're going. And these forces were very prominent at the time, the social. You've got to be, 10 years older, younger than me?
Yeah, we're in both in our early 60s, me and Guy. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, 10 years younger than you. 10 years younger than you.
Yeah. So, but it was a big thing culturally and the schools system. I mean, I hardly went to school, so I wouldn't know, but I really did rebel at school. I did not like being told what to do. And
did that run into being in the band with Ray? I mean, was that an issue?
No, it was okay, because we were family.
Right.
Yeah, I get it.
There was quite a lot of fighting on your stage, though, wasn't there? Not just between you.
Yeah, but it was. Yeah,
the more overt stuff was with Mick, wasn't it?
Mick, that seemed to be.
You nearly died. You nearly died one night, didn't you?
I saw it coming.
One inch the other way. Yeah.
No,
this is a hi hat. Apparently, Mick tried to hit Dave with a hi hat stand, which apparently, it would have sliced your neck open.
The things get dramatized and exaggerated.
But it's in your book, mate.
Yeah, I know, but you got me feeling colourful. Oh, God, I put my head back on. No, it was very, very awful. The audience thing for shit, because I thought it was a part of the show.
You know what's funny is in the book is because David Watts was a song, obviously, that is, I think it's what album's David Watts on, Dave?
Yes, good point.
Wish I could be like David Watts, right? So the Jam did it, didn't they? And obviously it was a big
Jam did, yeah.
And then in your book, we suddenly get to see who David Watts really was, and it wasn't anything like David Watts I imagined.
It wasn't like anybody I'd imagined.
One of those 60s movies, that whole scene at the house.
I was a bit of a lad, but I didn't know about homosexuality it was all fun and exciting.
What happened? Who was David Watts?
He was a promoter that lived in Rutland, Weekend. And who did that? Rutland Weekend.
That's Eric Idle. Eric Idle did Rutland Weekend television.
Anyway, we did this gig in Rutland. I was like, oh, great. And the promoter asked us to go back to his house for a few drinks. House, like a mansion, for a few drinks. And we get in there with a beer and I didn't have that stuff. I had some pink champagne, oh, I can give it a go. And one thing led to another. Longer the evening went on, I noticed that there were no women in the groups of people. And, and even local CID were gay guys. You know, I've never,
That's the amazing angle. I never
saw a copper with pink socks on before. And that was a giveaway.
Anyway, basically, well, David Watts fell in love with you a bit that night.
Yeah, excessively so. And, you know, I think really...
tried to swap you for his house.
Yeah, he probably thought it was saving a few years' misery. Get rid of him.
Ray Stein tried to swap you for his house.
Yeah. So the story goes, the Ray chatted up David Watts to get... to swap me for his house. Posh house. And I know, a silly sort of didn't tweak to Asia.
And then he wound you up even further by writing a song. I wish I could be like David Watts.
And he wound everybody up, especially David.
I wonder if the Jam would have been so keen on doing it if they knew that was the story.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's funny because I remember so many years later, I met Paul Weller and I was making a solo album at Conk, and he came around, I think about the beginning of the rise to fame, and he had a 45 of Susanna Still Alive.
Wow.
And he wanted me to sign it, and so I didn't have the heart to tell him about David Woods.
Dave, you've been part of some of the greatest records. I mean, it's unbelievable listening to this music over the last few days. I mean, days. There you go. There's an amazing song.
Oh, yeah. You know,
I played on Kirsty McCall's version of that.
It's great, Bird. It's great. Yeah.
There's always some connection with Guy playing bass on with every one of our guests. but the other one, of course, I mean, Lola, we can talk about that. You know, Ape Man, the first record I ever bought, Dave, ever.
Oh, man, bless you.
And I still have it downstairs. I was 10, and I went with my brother down to the record shop. We'd been working in the greengrocers, and we'd earned our wage packet. We decided we'd both buy a 7-inch record. And he bought The Tremors, Me and My Life, and I bought Ape Man.
Good choice.
Waterloo Sunset, I mean, almost certainly is on my list as one of the greatest songs ever ever written. Do you remember that moment? How was
this? Right, I get to say, I'm from Waterloo, all right? You're all from Islington. I'm from Waterloo.
Yeah.
So there you go.
That'll do. And he's experiencing the sunset of his life right now.
The sunset of my career, certainly.
Yes. But how was the writing, Dave? Did some of it come out of jamming, or did you just suddenly did Ray just say, come and have a listen to this?
Well, it was both. It was like Waterloo Sunset come out of a piano riff that Ray was playing. And we tied it up to fit the guitar sound at the time. And it's Ray's song. I mean, it's the heart song.
Yeah, but your guitarist is like, it's that thing of perfect arrangements. Those guitar licks of yours could not be more perfect than if there is nothing that would fit as well as they do, you know?
Well, thank you. But I thought that's what professional musicians did, is that you complimented the song.
Well, ideally, yes.
But it was more, a lot of the work we did, me and Ray, was done by instinct. And Ray was a craftsman, really, but there's so many nuances that go into a ploy or a character or a method. It's not easy, but sometimes it's accidental. All these things happen. It's like the weather, you know. It's pissing down the rain today. You change it. Music's a wonderful, wonderful way of creating peace, creating love, and creating things you didn't know you were aware of.
Because Leonard Bernstein talked about You Really Got Me, didn't he, as being a perfect expression of the Mixolydian mode or whatever.
Yeah.
You wouldn't know that.
No, but I do now.
Yeah.
I do now. She told me.
Do you know what? Talking about influences as well, Guy. You know, we missed because we talked to Shel Talmy about this, didn't we? See My Friends, which has that Indian drone in.
Oh, which is actually the first Indian thing, wasn't it?
Yeah. Before the Beatles ever did anything. Yeah. I mean, admittedly, Norwegian Wood had a sitar on it, but I think this was the first time any drone or any Asian influence had come into music. And it was with you guys again. How did you get that sound, by the way, that droning sound?
It's really like Ray had this idea for a song and we wanted a kind of a backbeat that was like a drone. Ray had this 12-string Primus guitar. We detuned it from the original streaming. So that sounded more like a drone. And then we mixed it in with my electric drone-y sound, and then it kind of evolved out of that. I don't know, Ray probably got a whole different story about it, but I always felt there was a lot of emotion, like seeing my friends playing across the river, like never to be seen. Kind of feeling.
Yeah, I want to finish up, Dave, by talking about a bit more about your influences as a band, because it's quite extraordinary. The first time I think, you know, I ever heard Where Have All the Good Times Gone, it would have been the Bowie version on Pinups. It wasn't actually your part. That version made me go back and listen to a lot more of your stuff. You know, but then you've got, you know, Stop Your Sobbing, Pretenders, The Hard Way. You know, there's so much inspiration that the Kinks have given bands that appeared in the
80s. Yeah, favourite covers of the Pink song is by the Stranglers, All Day and All of the Night.
Oh, right.
And that's one of my favourite. But, you know, I loved, you know, obviously when Van Halen covered You Really Got Me.
Yeah, yeah.
And became a worldwide success.
One thing's for sure, one thing I've learned is you've got a lot of love.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's been a real pleasure having you on. Real honour for us.
No, it's a real honour.
Great to see you guys, and thanks for making it easy.
Good luck with the book. And you've got an album, and they've got an album that complements the book, right?
Yeah, it's an album that we pieced together a bunch of songs that complement the book and remixes, and there's a nice version of a song I wrote called Strangers. It's about how we get to a point, we grow up in a family, like Dave's, our family, and you come to a point really, in a way, you're kind of strangers. You might have lived together for 10, 20 years or whatever, but really strangers. And it takes a while to get to know people, I think. It's really a song about friendship, I guess.
Dave, love to your brother. Just to finish off, I hear there's going to be more Kink stuff. Is that going to happen?
I hope so, yeah. Good. We're trying to get some... There's a lot of stuff there. You know, needs knocking to shape. And
get it together.
We need it. I've got to say, Dave, because you're someone who, you know what, frankly, you've been the soundtrack of mine. I've always listened to you, and I always will. And I know I can probably say the same for Gary.
Yeah,
so.
I played one of your songs at his 50th birthday party, didn't I?
You did.
Oh,
you did.
What was it?
Because You Really Got Me.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
All right, mate. All the best. All
right. Yeah, take care. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you, David. Thank you so much. Lots of love.
Oh, what a beautiful man.
What a beautiful man. And we barely scratched the surface. I really would recommend that book to anyone, because it's the... But then you need to put a lot of time aside, because you're going to be listening to a lot of music.
That's true. Absolutely. That's what you do. But it is very honest, isn't it? It's, I mean, it's unbelievably honest.
Unflinching, I believe, is the word one would use. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So thank you for listening. Oh, it's so nice to be back. I'm sorry we had to take a break for a couple of weeks. I know I've got some texts and emails from friends who listen and go, what am I meant to be doing on a Sunday morning? Now you're not here.
I know, so we're responsible for everyone now, aren't we?
It's true. We accompany dog walks and coffees and all kinds of things, avoiding real life.
That's right.
But we're back for a while. We've got quite.
We've got quite the list. We have got quite the list, people. So keep it here.
All right. It's good night from me.
Good night from them.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.